Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the White House is hailing George Bush's latest executive order as a strong statement against torture. But the claims have been met by a remarkably skeptical press corps. We'll talk to Georgetown Law professor and author David Cole about the president's supposed torture ban and the press reaction. Also on the program, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 14,000 recently. And if you weren't excited, well, you just weren't paying attention. At least that's corporate media's line, and they're sticking to it. We'll talk to Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research about media's stock market party and why they insist you're invited. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
The New Republic is running a series about bad behavior by U.S. soldiers in Iraq, written by Scott Thomas, a pseudonym, say the editors, for a freelance writer and soldier currently serving in Baghdad. Among other things, Thomas describes U.S. soldiers ridiculing a disfigured woman in a mess hall, a Bradley vehicle driver who enjoys running over dogs, and a soldier who wears part of a human skull on his head. The series is under attack by conservatives who have questioned the authenticity of the writer, invoking past episodes where the New Republic has been caught publishing fabricated stories. Fair enough on the New Republic's history, but so far the critics have produced no evidence challenging the series' authenticity. So it was odd to see the New York Times weighing in with a report casting doubt on the series. "Doubts raised on magazine's Baghdad Diarist" was the headline over a Times reporter Luis Story's report, which was largely a recitation of conservative complaints. The Times added no new evidence that the work was fraudulent. Indeed, the closest thing to evidence the Times or its conservative sources have furnished is an editor at the Weekly Standard magazine who was quoted saying that, in response to a call by the Standard for knowledgeable people to discredit the New Republic series, quote, "there's not a single person who has come forward and said, it sounds plausible," close quote. Yes, the evidence is that pathetic. So where's the news? It's true, skepticism may be warranted, but shouldn't the Times have evidence of fraud before running accusations of fabrication and promoting a pet conservative peeve? Interestingly, neither the New York Times nor a Howard Kurtz report in the Washington Post, which also parroted the Wright's accusations, mention a lengthy Nation piece quoting more than 50 U.S. soldiers on the record describing far more atrocious behavior by U.S. soldiers.
This past week, Senator Hillary Clinton addressed the Senate about a bill proposing to make higher education more affordable. That sounds like something that might be of interest to many Americans. But for Washington Post columnist Robin Given, the story, incredibly, was all in what the reporter perceived as Clinton's cleavage on display. Given compared what she called Clinton's teasing display to her earlier desexualized clothing, of which, quote, "one was not even tempted to mention the S word," close quote. Given then described cleavage in general as a request to be engaged in a particular way, a provocation, and to Clinton's neckline as discomforting, equivalent to, quote, "catching a man with his fly unzipped," close quote. But truth be told, there isn't a male equivalent to the kind of attention regarded to Clinton's so-called cleavage. You'd be hard-pressed to find the Post applying the same scrutiny to the sexiness of Dick Cheney's attire, and even John Edwards' haircut, as famous as it is, isn't mocked in the media for its sexual attractiveness or lack thereof. And thank goodness, by the way. Unfortunately, discrediting female politicians based on perceived failures at femininity is nothing new, especially for Given. In 2000, Given attempted to dress up a similarly trivial assessment of Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris, writing, quote, "one wonders how this Republican woman, who can't even use restraint when she's wielding a mascara wand, will manage to use it and make sound decisions in this game of partisan one-upmanship," close quote. Someone should tell the Post, everything old is not new again. Whether it runs in the style section or on the front page, analyzing female politicians by their appearance instead of their policies isn't journalism, just sexism.
CNN is allowing Muslim-baiting headline news host Glenn Beck to sell mattresses as part of his show. CNN hasn't in the past allowed its on-air personalities to do sale pitches, but they say that Beck's different, in part because, quote, the advertiser has a relationship with Glenn Beck that extends beyond his headline news program, close quote. Seems they also advertise on his radio show. Well, that doesn't make much sense, but don't spend too much time trying to puzzle it out, because it turns out Beck might not be so different after all. The cable news network says they're considering using other on-air personnel, including Nancy Grace, to shill for sponsors, which makes something of a joke out of their claim to respect the, quote, long-standing journalistic practice of keeping news free of commercial messages to preserve editorial integrity, close quote. But that's a wall that seems to be falling down all over. A recent study published in the journal Electronic News found that 90% of the local newscasts it examined contained what it called stealth advertising, segments that are presented as news but are actually designed to promote a sponsor. Such disguised ads appeared an average of 2.5 times per broadcast, the study found.
You've probably found yourself wondering about the sources some high-profile pundits rely on for the misinformation they emit regularly. If one recent example is an indication, the answer may be from nowhere at all. In a recent appearance on MSNBC's Meet the Press, New York Times op-ed columnist David Brooks admitted to pulling a number out of thin air. On July 22nd, Brooks cited the Times' own reporter, John Burns, to argue that postponing U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq would, quote, prevent 10,000 Iraqi deaths a month, close quote. This figure raised some questions, not for Meet the Press's so-called bulldog host Tim Russert, but from fellow guest Bob Woodward. Woodward asked, 10,000 dying, where does that come from? And Brooks responded, quote, well, A, it comes from John Burns. Second, it comes from the National Intelligence, close quote. Woodward interrupted him to say, well, no, he doesn't say 10,000. To which Brooks responded, well, no, but it talks about genocide. Finally, David Brooks admitted, quote, so I just picked that 10,000 out of the air, close quote. That's it. He, the New York Times columnist, just picked the number out of the air. Meanwhile, epidemiologists who applied the standard tools of their profession to Iraq have concluded that the death toll under U.S. occupation is approximately 15,000 a month. Somehow, though, they're denied David Brooks's access to mainstream media discussion.
And finally, a July 23rd New York Times story described efforts of marketers to figure out ways to get advertising into podcasts, those audio web files that can be downloaded for listening. The article treats the development as unsurprising, which unfortunately it is, and notes that as part of the solution to the ostensible problem of ad-free programming, a new industry group has been formed to, quote, help executives improve methods for creating, distributing, and tracking advertisements in podcasts, close quote. As one analyst puts it, quote, the idea of creating an association to focus on this is great. It's going to help companies monetize all this content, close quote. You might be surprised to learn that one of 15 founding companies looking to monetize all that content is National Public Radio. Time was when the country's supposedly non-commercial network, co-founding an industry group with the express goal of pushing ads, might have elicited some comment. That time would appear to have passed.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
George Bush has benefited from an exceptionally docile press corps, so it was remarkable to see the media reaction to his July 20th executive order supposedly banning CIA torture. The White House hailed the directive as a strong statement against torture. After all, didn't it forbid CIA interrogators from techniques including torture, murder, religious denigration, and humiliating or degrading treatment? Well, that's what it said, but few in the media seem to be buying. A Miami Herald editorial fairly ridiculed the president, comparing his directive to a cease and desist order, quote, in which a defendant withholds admission of wrongful activity but agrees to stop doing it anyway, close quote. Similarly, the Washington Post editors, who have been among Bush's staunchest media cheerleaders, suggested the executive order meant a return to an abusive interrogation program that had been put on hold last year following charges that it violated U.S. and international law. With us to sort out the executive order is David Cole, professor at Georgetown University Law Center, the author of several books, including Enemy Aliens, Double Standards, and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. His column on the executive order was published by Salon on July 23rd. David Cole, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, George Bush says his new directive bans torture and requires that CIA interrogations comply with the Geneva Convention's prohibition against outrages upon personal dignity and humiliating and degrading treatment. But the Washington Post report on the directive said Bush had set broad legal boundaries for the CIA's harsh interrogation program. How do you see it?
Well, I think the Washington Post is right. I mean, this is a very, very vague order. It does not specify what tactics the CIA can use and cannot use, as, for example, the Army Field Manual does. That's what governs Army interrogations, and it's very specific about what tactics can and cannot be used. This order, by contrast, relies on very broad terms like cruel and inhuman and the like, without specifying what's in and what's out with respect to the interrogation. So, for example, we don't even know whether waterboarding, which is one of the tactics the CIA was using before, is prohibited or permitted by this order.
Well, as you say, the order lacks specifics, and that's been widely observed in the press. And since Bush has denied the U.S. has used torture in the past in regard to practices deemed abusive by international norms, there's a big problem here with definitions, especially when the president's speaking.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, if it was a different administration with a different history and they issued an order like this saying the CIA can't torture, the CIA can't engage in cruel and inhuman treatment and the like, we would think, yeah, that's right. I mean, it should go without saying, but we want to honor the international treaty bans on torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, the Geneva Convention, and the like. But what we've seen with respect to this administration is that time and time again, it has sought to interpret those provisions, those bans, not to honor their spirit and letter, but rather has treated them almost like a tax lawyer would treat the tax code, looking for loopholes that they can exploit. So they interpreted the prohibition on torture to apply only to physical pain that rose to the level of organ failure or death. Or they interpreted the prohibition on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, a prohibition that is an international treaty, a human rights treaty that we were very central in getting enacted and which we ratified. They interpreted that not to cover foreigners who are held by the CIA abroad, only Americans. It was not an American rights treaty. It was a human rights treaty, and yet that's how they interpreted it in order to free themselves up to engage in waterboarding. They interpreted the Geneva Convention not to apply to the conflict with Al-Qaeda, an interpretation rejected outright by the Supreme Court, all, again, driven by this desire to use coercive tactics. And the same thing is true with this executive order. It was issued not for the purpose of reining in the CIA, but rather for the purpose of freeing up the CIA to continue what the administration calls enhanced interrogation tactics.
Well, I want to get to that. You're just touching on my next question, and that is, while Bush's order is met with a lot of scrutiny by the press, you picked up on something that we didn't see anywhere else. You wrote, "The executive order's most revealing words come at the end," and suggested that in some sense the directive may serve to cover for would-be abusers. Could you explain that?
Well, that's right. If you get to the last section of the order, and it's in two parts, and the first part says, "Nothing in the above gives rise to any right that anyone who is abused by or allegedly abused by a U.S. official can sue under." So the order gives rise to no rights for potential victims of CIA interrogation tactics. Part two of the final section says the CIA officials who are sued can cite this order as a complete defense to any suit against them. So the aim of this is not to protect potential victims, but to protect the potential perpetrators.
Now, even if we were able to agree on definitions and assuming for the sake of argument that Bush's directive actually did faithfully order compliance with Geneva and the Torture Convention, how forceful can an executive order be that outlines no penalties for violating it?
Well, that's the problem, right? If they meant this to actually have some teeth, they would say a violation of this will lead to the following sanctions, whether it be damages or whether it be some other kind of a penalty. But they say quite the opposite. And in this morning's Washington Post, there's an op-ed from a former military person and a professor at University of Virginia, Robert Turner, who was one of the most adamant defenders of the administration on virtually everything else in the war on terror, condemning this order because it fails to abide by the Geneva Conventions, where the Geneva Conventions prohibit outrageous conduct and outrageous and humiliating treatment of detainees. This doesn't do that. What this says is if the CIA engages in physical abuse for the purpose of humiliation, then it will violate the order. But if they engage in this kind of physical abuse for the purpose of gathering intelligence, then they're not violating the order. It's that kind of game playing with the language. Again, not trying to honor the spirit of these prohibitions, but instead trying to turn them into loopholes which can be used so that people can be abused by the CIA, that I think has left the administration with zero credibility on this set of issues.
What do you make of the fact that this directive is, somewhat remarkably, considering recent history, being met by widespread media skepticism, even cynicism in some cases?
Well, I think everybody learns. In the beginning, you know, I think people give the government the benefit of the doubt, particularly when the government is out there trying to protect us and we're afraid. But when we, you know, learn, when we see the Abu Ghraib photos, when we see the kinds of tactics that the FBI described observing at Guantanamo, where people were locked and shackled to floors so long that they urinated and defecated on themselves, or where someone was injected with IV fluid and then not allowed to go to the bathroom, so he urinated on himself. When you see that kind of stuff go on with the administration's approval, then people begin to say, wait a minute, this is not an administration we can trust, and we've got to look at everything they say with real skepticism.
We've been speaking with David Cole, Georgetown law professor and author most recently of Less Safe, Less Free, Why America is Losing the War on Terrorism. You can read his column on Bush's torture directive at Salon.com. David Cole, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
As corporate media coverage of the John Edwards campaign illustrates, politicians are punished for talking about poverty and economic inequality in this country, not for proffering the wrong solutions, but just for bringing the subject up. It's not really news that there are some people who think inequality is an unpleasantry that wouldn't exist if we just didn't talk about it, but have journalists internalized this idea, such that even their news reporting reflects more about how some imagine the economy functions than how it really does. It's a conclusion one might draw from recent champagne popping going on in media over the supposedly record-high stock market, which until very recently we were told really was a rising tide that was lifting all boats. Here to help us sort through some of the economic myths that once again seem to be in the air is Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of the blog Beat the Press, which tracks economic reporting. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I feel like we've had this conversation more than once before, but here we go again. Record days on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was at 14,000. And to hear media tell it, every working man or woman should have been as excited about that as the biggest tycoon. NBC's Erin Burnett spelled it out on the Today Show on July 17th. She said, quote, "While the rich are getting richer, you may be too. Here's why. More than half of Americans are invested in the market, whether through a 401k plan or buying stocks or mutual funds, and many of those investments are surging," close quote. Just in case you didn't understand it, she was there on the nightly news explaining, quote, "That means the majority of Americans directly benefit benefit from what happens on Wall Street, close quote. Well, now that weather vane has shifted a bit, but I wonder if you could address this direct connection between the Dow Jones and yours and my economic well-being that seems to undergird this coverage.
Okay, well, there's 2 points here. First off, just in terms of getting the basic numbers right, because it's being a little fast and loose, it probably is more than half, but it's very, very slightly more than half. So in terms of, you know, what percentage of families own stock, either, you know, again, either directly or through 401ks, and for the vast majority of families, it is through 401ks or other retirement plans. The percent that has stock, according to the most recent Federal Reserve Board survey on this, is just about 50%. So, you know, we could say it's more than half, but it's just barely so. So most people, most people own stock, almost half the people don't. Now, of those who own stock, the median holding is about 25,000. So 75% of the population has less than 25,000 invested in the stock market. So if you have 25,000 sitting there, you're probably happy if it went up, but it's not going to make your fortune. Now, flipping that over, what drives the stock market up? Well, you know, there's basically two stories you could tell. One is that you could have stocks being driven up by expectations of future profits, which, you know, is a good thing, obviously, if you hold a lot of stock. But if the future profits are at the expense of wages, that probably is not a good thing. And oftentimes that will be the case. Profits have risen to some extent at the expense of wages for the people who rely on wages for their living. That's not good news. The other factor that could drive the stock market up, and I think that's been partly the case the last few months, and certainly was the case in the late 90s, is what, you know, Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan called irrational exuberance, just a bubble. People get carried away. That's not particularly good news for most people, probably not even good news for most stockholders, because bubbles eventually burst. And, you know, if people come to think that, you know, they have however much money sitting there in the stock market, and then it turns out, as happened in 2001, 2002, the market falls 20, 30, 40%, they're in for a very, very rude surprise. So the idea that somehow the stock market is a reliable measure of the well-being of, you know, most of the economic well-being of most of the country, it really doesn't make any sense.
Well, NBC's Erin Burnett tried to tie in wages as well. She argued that, quote, while politicians talk about two Americas, virtually all Americans are seeing wages rise and unemployment is at an historic low, close quote. Now, you addressed another iteration of this line coming from the New York Times columnist David Brooks. He also pointed to rising wages, saying they were rising sharply in his July 24th piece. What's the story on wages?
Well, there's a lot of game playing here. It's really dishonest. I mean, and perhaps these people are just unfamiliar with the data, but if you take, and here's what David Brooks did. I can't speak to the NBC piece because I haven't heard it, but David Brooks took from January 06 to January 07, picking 2 months where you did show a large wage increase in real wages, and the reason was simply oil price fluctuations. So it depended on picking January to January. What you would want to do if you're trying to be honest about that is you take a three-month average, take a six-month average, and we could do that. It's not a hard thing to do. And if you actually look over the course of this business cycle, our average hourly wage in, you know, taking the most recent data, and again, you can take a three-month average if you like, going back for the last 3 months, it's basically the same as it was in 2002. So we've had 5 years of essentially zero wage growth. It was a really bad story. I mean, in a normal, healthy economy, you take the late 90s, wages were growing at the rate of about 1.6% a year. So here we have 5 years of zero wage growth. So, you know, the fact that one could find a month and say, okay, a year ago from January, wages rose 2%, that's just silly. You know, I mean, it's just not an honest way to convey what's going on.
It's hardly as though these arguments begin and end there, though. They're using wages really as an indication to say, in Brooks's words, we're in the middle of one of the greatest economic eras ever, you know, so it's not a little statistical slight. They're premising things on this.
No, and it's absolutely dishonest because, you know, again, I maybe he really doesn't know what he's doing, but, you know, the point is this is what you'd want to see is sustained wage growth, not that I could pick 1 month, 2 months, 3 months and go a year ago wages were lower. Well, you know, when you're talking about an economic boom the way David Brooks was talking about, well, we should be seeing a sustained wage growth over a 3, 4, 5 year period, not cherry picking a few months where we could say we're better off this year than last year. That's just really dishonest.
What else was going on in that David Brooks column that you felt really required some sort of response?
Well, you know, there were a lot of tricks in there. I mean, one of the issues, you know, why are people getting ahead? And David Brooks was trying to make the argument that, you know, when you look at the really high earners, the CEOs, the hedge fund people, that they're getting ahead simply because, you know, they're very smart and they're contributing so much to the economy. And I guess I'd just say two things on that. One is, if they're contributing so much to the economy, we'd expect to see overall economic growth to be very strong. And, of course, it hasn't been. In fact, one of the you know, perhaps the most basic measure of how well are we doing, how well is the economy doing, is productivity growth. How much, you know, how much more are we producing per hour this year than last year? And if you look at that, over the last 4 years, there's been a big slowdown, or I should say 3 years. I'll get you the fourth in a second. Over the last 3 years, there's been a big slowdown in the rate of productivity growth. The fourth year comes from the fact that the Federal Reserve Board is now projecting that that will continue through 2008. So if I wanted to be David Brooks and really make an honest case, I'd say, look at this. Productivity is soaring because we have all these really smart CEOs and hedge fund managers, and they're getting the economy, getting capital invested in the right places, and therefore productivity growth is soaring. Well, we don't see that. Productivity growth has been slumping. So that part of the story doesn't fit.
Well, finally, it seems to me an argument that seems fundamentally disengaged. I mean, David Brooks says the U.S. economy, despite all the bad-mouthing, is chugging along. Now, I don't think he'd really tell a single parent with two jobs who's not making the rent that their problem is bad-mouthing. It seems to me his dialogue is really only with other rich people who have the nerve to talk about inequality. You know, it's all just kind of shadows on the wall to these people.
Yeah, I mean, we both have data, we have we have polling data, we have economic data. We have an awful lot of people who are clearly having a very hard time making ends meet in the sense of paying their rent, paying a mortgage, paying for their health care for themselves, for their kids, figuring out how they're going to deal with a kid who's has to stay home sick when they don't have leave from their job and they can't hire someone to care for the kid. I mean, that's the reality for tens of millions of people in the country. And we know that. I mean, there's no ambiguity. We have all sorts of data sets that show that. We have polling data that says this is a concern for people. So the idea for Brooks that you just have a few talking heads that are sort of speaking abstractly that, oh, we have these problems out there. Well, you do have some talking heads that speak abstractly that way. But the fact is, we have the data. We know that that is the reality for tens of millions of people.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find his blog, Beat the Press, on the website of American Prospect magazine. That's prospect.org. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me on.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.